There's nothing more beautiful in a church building than the sound of children. And there's nothing quite as distressing as no children sounds in church. We live in a world that is hungering and thirsting and maybe even starving for joy. Pleasure mania has given folks every reason possible for laughing. And yet some words like laughter and pleasure, they don't quite fit with the word joy. And here's the problem. When life is hitting on every cylinder, if you're a farm boy, you get this, probably all of us do. When you're tying every bell, when there are more reasons to smile than to cry, for many, they think joy has been captured. But what about when your health fails? Or you lose your job, or there's a plane wreck. We've seen that this past week. Or when houses are destroyed by fire. I talked to a fireman today, and over here on 10th Street, just right over here, maybe right back there, very recently there was a fire there and there was a fatality. When houses are destroyed and lives. Well, the question is, does joy disappear along with the light at the end of the tunnel? In other words, when only laughter and pleasure add up to joy, then grief and struggle, they sort of add up to misery. And by the way, God's Word verified that whole approach years ago. You know, this approach from the world, Proverbs 14:13, even in laughter, the heart is sad. And the end of joy is grief. And so real peace, real blessedness, real joy, they're not dependent on being in the right situation at the right time. I mean, listen to me. Joy is found only in the Lord. And that joy is found even on the really, really tough days. Now, obviously, some folks are happy with the way things are. They think they have found joy. They don't need this joy in the Lord. But that's because things are good. It's a, you know, smooth sailing. But think about this. Satan is not opposed to your life, my life, feeling like, hey, it's just smooth sailing. He's not opposed to that. Prosperity and health and wealth are in his toolbox. And it's so easy to be deceived, to believe that you have a joy-filled life until, you know, your world crumbles and you face something that money can't fix or you can't fix. In Philippians chapter 1, and I hope you'll turn over there with me tonight. That's our text for tonight. There we find Paul dealing with some really tough circumstances. But he's determined to continue embracing joy and challenging his brethren in this letter to do the same. And from this chapter, we're going to discover the secret for which the world is searching, the cure for misery on the tough days. Often we hesitate to pour out our hearts and to share our burdens with others, fearful that they just won't understand. Well, listen to me. Paul, the Apostle Paul, would understand. Because he was the runaway favorite for the in the wrong place at the right at the wrong time award for the first century church. I mean, talk about struggles. He lists them in his letter to the Second Corinthians. 5 times beaten with 39 stripes. Now, the reason it was 39 stripes, he's talking about beatings he got from Jews. And the Jews were taught you can lash them 40 times, but if you do 41 times, then you got to take 40. And so, you know, safety margin, they'd stop at 39. Five times he was beaten with 39 stripes. Three times beaten with rods. He was stoned once. He was shipwrecked. We're all familiar with one, but he was shipwrecked three times. He was robbed. He was hunted. He was stalked. And so, yes, Paul can sympathize and empathize. He understands. And Paul writes these brethren at Philippi a letter about rejoicing while in the custody of the Roman government. This whole saga began in Jerusalem and then on to Caesarea, where in custody he finally just appealed to Caesar to stop a plot of the Jews assassinating him. And so he made his way to Rome. You remember, on the way to Rome, there was a shipwreck at Malta. And he had a meal there around a campfire. That's the reason they call it Malta meal, I'm sure, right? But he went through an incredible hardship just getting to Rome. And at Rome, when he arrived to Rome, he was turned over to the captain of the guard and then was under house arrest 2 years waiting to appear before Nero. Now, imagine walking in Paul's room. He's been there for a year and a half, and you're going to cheer him up. Paul had been very successful in planting many congregations, and many scholars believe that he was going to Spain. He tells us he was going to go to Spain, but he was going to go all the way around the Mediterranean Sea planting churches. Cheering up. What are you going to say? Hey, Paul, you are needing some rest anyway, so just kick back and enjoy. You know, he's under arrest, but he was under house arrest. And people could come and go. Or Paul, you've been having trouble with your eyes, so just consider this an early retirement. And at least, Paul, this is better than being dead. And he's going to have something to say about that later in this letter. Or Paul, you've done your share. Let somebody else worry about the loss. The fact is, Paul was not down in the dumps. He wasn't depressed. Look at chapter 1, verse 12. Philippians 1, 12. I want you to know, beloved, that what has happened to me has actually helped to spread the gospel so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to everyone else that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers and sisters, having been made confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, dare to speak the word with greater boldness and without fear. And so the imprisonment, he says, good news. It's actually helped spread the gospel. The word translated spread in the original language was used to describe the progress of an army. And the word literally means to cut down in advance. Like cutting back the trees and the brush and clearing a path so that the army could move efficiently and quickly. That's how that word was used in a military sense. And that's what Paul's imprisonment had done. It had cleared the way for the gospel to move forward. It wasn't a barrier to spreading the gospel. Paul says, this just threw the door open. It cleared the path. Now, how did it do that? Verse 13, so that it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to everyone that my imprisonment is for Christ. Now, the imperial guard or the praetorian guard, they were palace guards who protected, in a broad sense, the best entrance of Rome. But they also provided security for the emperor. It was formed by Emperor Augustus. 10,000 men. You can imagine bodyguards. 10,000 men were handpicked. And he actually didn't just keep them in Rome. He spread them throughout the city of Rome and the neighboring cities. Emperor Tiberius consecrated them in Rome and built a special fortified camp for their protection. Vitalius, that emperor, increased them to 16,000 and had them to serve 16 years instead of 12 years. And when they retired, after 16 years, they received great sums of money and full citizenship. By the first century, the Praetorian Guard had become the most powerful political force in the Roman Empire. They actually determined who would be the next Caesar by imposing their will, if necessary, by force. And it was to the commanding officer that Paul was delivered. He was then given freedom to live in his own house. Now, is that the microphone? Y'all can hear me, can't you? Now, JR, you may have to open that door back there to hear me. Now, he was given freedom to live in his own house, but a soldier was connected to him constantly. Visitors were allowed to come and go, but the guard was there always at his side. Oh, that was terrible. No, that was wonderful. For 2 years, Paul had a captive audience among the most influential group of men in the Roman Empire. And guess what they all heard about? They heard about Christ. But there was more. Verse 14, "And most of the brothers and sisters, having been made confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, dare to speak the word with greater boldness and without fear." Now, other Christians were standing up and speaking up. Paul was their example, and now they're preaching boldly and fearlessly. And so the cure for tough circumstances is seen in this passage. But beware, it's more than just, well, I'm just going to think positive. No, it's more than just a positive, healthy outlook on life. Paul didn't find this cure, in other words, under house arrest, after he was arrested and shipwrecked and finally arrived in Rome. It was his source of victory from the time he came to know Christ. Every moment, the good times and the bad times. Now, here's another challenge he faced. Look at verse 15. "Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add afflictions to my chains. But the latter, out of love, knowing that I'm appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached. And in this I rejoice." Yes, and will rejoice. While many brethren loved him and were motivated by his example, as he mentions, others were not. Yes, they proclaimed Christ, but he says it was out of selfish ambition. That word translated from the Greek with the English words selfish ambition was not necessarily a bad word. It wasn't a bad thing. It literally meant you were working for hire or you were working for pay. And in this context, Paul is describing proclaimers of the gospel who were preaching only for the benefit they received. They were advancing themselves. They were building a following for themselves. Paul is under house arrest, and they saw this as an opportunity to advance themselves. And notice, Paul didn't accuse them of preaching false doctrine. But their motive was ungodly. And they obviously were attacking Paul's character. This is amazing. Have you ever been backstabbed? Is there anything harder than being stabbed in the back? Paul is dealing with backstabbers, and yet he's rejoicing in the end result that Christ was being preached. He knew they were envious. He knew they were full of strife and contention, but he writes, "And in this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice." Now that's a cure for bad circumstances. But there's one more fact to Paul's circumstances that makes his joy just amazing. And that's in verse 21. He says, For to me, to live is Christ. Is that true of you? To live is Christ. And to die is gain. Paul knew that death was a possibility. I mean, he's going to appear before Nero. Anytime you appear before Nero, there's a good chance it's not going to turn out great. Suetonius, a Roman historian, wrote that it was during the time of Nero that, and I quote, "punishments were also inflicted on the Christians, a sect professing a new and mischievous religious belief." Nero was a cruel, perverted man. He tried to poison his own mother. He thought she was going to, you know, take him off the throne. He tried to poison her three times before he killed her. Had her murdered. He even kicked a pregnant wife to death. He never hesitated to put the accused to death. Life meant nothing to him. The value of a life, nothing. Paul knew that he would be standing before this tyrant who was not sympathetic to Christian, yet notice the view of his life. Verse 22. "But if I live on in the flesh, that will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I cannot tell. For I'm hard pressed between the two." In other words, he's between a rock and a hard place. "Having the desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and your joy of faith, that your rejoicing may be more abundant in Christ Jesus by my coming to you." Paul was confident. Didn't matter. Either way, he was going to help these brethren to rejoice unless he went to be with the Lord. But of course, with the blessing of joy comes an ever-present challenge. Look at verse 27. "Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel." That original word translated conduct is another interesting word. Normally, Paul would use a word that means to walk about. We talked about this morning. Walk in the light. Not the darkness. But this word didn't mean that. It meant to be a citizen. Paul's in the capital city of the Roman Empire. He's writing to Philippi, to a Roman colony. And Philippi was, of course, many miles from Rome. But every Roman citizen knew no matter how far you were from Rome, you always conducted yourself as a loyal Roman citizen. You spoke the Latin language. You wore Latin dress. You called your magistrates by Latin names. And that's what this word means. And his point was obvious. No matter what happens or where it happens, You behave as a citizen of the kingdom of Christ. Remain true. Remain faithful, pure, righteous. But more than this, you hold on to grace and peace. And so, you're facing tough circumstances. What's the cure? What's the secret to joy? And no, I'm not talking about, you know, happiness with real shallow roots. That's the result of good times. Paul, bottom line, how can we be faithful? Verse 21 is the verse we need to take home with us this week. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. It's a single-mindedness. To live is Christ. What is that, exactly does that mean? Well, as Paul was incarcerated, what took place? Christ was preached to the Praetorian Guard. The gospel